business strategies for the long haul. And I think this is going to be a nice follow-on to Jim and Dan's presentations to start with, because this is going to talk about how you sort of look for the kinds of jobs and projects you need to get to where you want to go. So I think this will be a really good discussion of that. We have Michael Kotis and Sarah Webb, and I think since we're all freelancers and we have to market ourselves, we'll let people introduce themselves and give as much background as they want to. But they both have lots of experience, and they're going to sort of do their presentation a little differently. They're going to talk back and forth through what they want to cover instead of doing one and then the other. If you have a question as they're presenting on the specific thing they're talking about, they're happy to take questions then. If you have a broader, more general question, we'll save about half an hour at the end for the sort of bigger picture things. But if you want to ask them to explain or expand on something, put a hand up and we'll try and get to you then. So you can ask specific questions during the talk as they go along. So, and just one other thing. Since I'm remembering it right now, Susan, I'll just say it now. In the afternoon after lunch, we're going to have a session reading some pitches and looking at them and talking about what we think works and doesn't work. By lunchtime, we should have some copies of them in the back. They were emailed around, but if you didn't get them and you want to read them, Susan will have them, and we'll probably have them on a table or something back there. And I'll try to remember to mention that again when we break for lunch. Okay.
Is that better? Yeah, I can hear myself now. Okay, so I'm Michael Kotis, and I'll get in a little bit more into my background later in the presentation, but I'm like Jim, I joined the ranks of the freelancers in 2008, and almost in the exact same market that he was in. We were both in Connecticut, I believe, at the time. I was a staff journalist for 25 years before that, first as a photojournalist and then as kind of a writer, photographer, videographer, you know, whatever needed to be done. I could, you know, run the printing press if I had to. I'll hand it off to Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah Webb. I am a freelance journalist based here in Chattanooga, so I'm your hometown gal. My whole journalism career has pretty much been as a freelancer, so that's one thing that I will, you know, talk a little bit about, as we go along. I did not start from a traditional staff position, so that's one thing. When we talk a little bit more about the details and the nuts and bolts, I'll talk a little bit about how I, you know, built a, you know, career starting, you know, as pretty much a new science journalist and a new freelancer. But what we're going to talk about are, business strategies for the long haul. And the truth of all of this is that if you're a freelancer, you are a business, even if you don't think so. And I think it's easy for us as, you know, it's easy for us as journalists to decide you're a journalist, and then, oh, I'm a freelancer, oh, then I have to think about these business issues. But if you're running an independent operation, the business issues really have to be a core part of your planning and a core part of how you think about how you operate, because you really have to come at this from a pretty different mindset if you are a freelancer than if you have a traditional job. And one thing that you constantly have to be thinking about is, you know, obviously you have that great story you want to write, you have, you know, these professional goals that you want to achieve, but then there's also, where is the money going to actually come from? How are the bills going to get paid? And so we're going to talk about some of the, you know, issues that are involved in, you know, making those two things work together. And a lot of times those two things feel like they're competing with one another, but that's really where, trying to get, you know, those two things moving in the same direction is really key to making freelancing work. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the freelancing Venn diagram. I did not come up with this. This is sort of my pictorial representation of something that, I've, you know, talked with any number of freelancers about, and if anyone in the room knows Christy Ashwanden, this is something that, you know, that she talks about a lot. So this is sort of an idea that I think a lot of us who have been freelancing a long time think a bit about. So if you can think of freelancing a bit like a three-legged stool. You have certain things that you want to do to build your career, get to the next level, advance. You obviously have projects that you're really excited about, that you're passionate about, that you really want to pursue. And you have to make money. And the thing about it is that there is that little spot in the center of the Venn diagram where all of those things come together. And the reality is that the projects that do all three of those are probably fewer and farther between than any of us would like. So sometimes you have to think about, you know, maybe, you know, looking at something that, I mean, I can use an example right now. As part of the Science Writers Handbook project, something that I've been really involved with is basically I'm the editor-in-chief of the website that goes with the Science Writers Handbook. And the reality of that is that for me is pretty much career building and passion. I'm not making, you know, that project is not paying my bills. But it's something that's allowing me to do some editorial work. It's allowing me to expand my web skills. And it's something that I'm really passionate about. So, and I'm hoping that it will lead to other projects down the line. The other thing that I can tell you is that before I moved to Chattanooga about a year ago, I was freelancing from New York City, and my husband was getting a PhD. So I was paying New York City living expenses, and I was the primary income. So I've spent a lot of my freelance career being very conscious of that profit, because the money had to come, and if we didn't have enough money, we weren't going to, you know, we weren't going to pay the bills. So, and so you really have to think, strategically about, you know, what mix of things are going to get you the right amount of money, what mix of things are going to help you grow, what mix of things feed those passions that you really want to pursue. And I'm going to hand it off to Michael.
So, I'm kind of up here as the bad example, because I'm pretty much the worst freelancer in the world. Just 25 years on staff, and I left the Hartford Courant in 2008 in a buyout, and thought it would take about a year for me to transition into being a freelancer. And the very day after I left the Hartford Courant, I got a big assignment for a big magazine, and I thought that was just going to be great. And then 5 months later, when I had no more big assignments from big magazines and was piecemealing with some local advertorial magazines around where I live, I realized it was going to be much more difficult than I thought. I got very fortunate to get a Scripps Fellowship in Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And if you haven't caught on, we're kind of an infestation here. All of this years are here. And Susan, who put this whole thing together, is a former Scripps Fellow. And I got even more fortunate that everybody I dealt with when I was a fellow forgot what I was like. And I got a job over the summer as the associate director of the Center for Environmental Journalism. So these things kind of helped to save me. But I've also been fortunate that I've been able to sell some big projects. And so I'll talk about pursuing books and at the level where you can really actually have that be the lion's share of what you do and how to piece that out. But to kind of give a sense of what what my life has kind of turned into, my primary thing right now is dealing with wildfire. So I had a piece where I was actually a guest on All Things Considered on Sunday. While I don't get paid for that, my publisher loves it, and it's all of those radio pieces and TV pieces I end up doing lead to other assignments, lead to magazine work, etc. And then on Monday, less than 12 hours after this All Things Considered thing, I was down around Denver shooting a documentary for The Guardian on a story there, and then raced back and was teaching a science writing class that the director of the Center for Environmental Journalism had to go in and cover for me for an hour while I finished this shoot and got back. And then yesterday morning, I was teaching another class, and this is on entrepreneurial ventures in media. It's basically for journalists that want to start their own businesses. And again, I kind of see myself as the instructor who's the bad example because I've done everything wrong. And I brought in a guest yesterday who was basically kind of the king of adventure filmmakers in Boulder, Colorado, which is the capital of adventure filmmaking pretty much in the country. It's where these big adventure film fests are based, et cetera. And, I mean, this guy has made, you know, 5 documentaries about climbing Mount Everest. He shot a huge chunk of all the stuff on James Baylog and the Extreme Ice Survey. He's done stuff for Frontline. He's really had everything everywhere. He's really quite well known. And as we were walking over, I talked about, well, you know, one of my biggest pieces of advice for my students is, you know, don't get out of college and max out your credit cards because you're going to be a famous photojournalist and put together all this studio with $50,000 and then learn 5 years later that that's not the direction that you're going to move in or that's not what the market supports and you've got credit card debt of $50,000 and you're only using $5,000 of the equipment that you bought and the rest of it's just gathering dust. And my friend Michael sat down in front of the class and he goes, well, you guys all know me and I did this and I did this and I did this. And I want to tell you that, you know, when I was winning these Emmys, I had done exactly what you're being told not to do. I'd maxed out all my credit cards and I was going to collect my Emmys and I declared bankruptcy pretty much the same week. And so, you know, just because you're successful getting really great material out there and doing the kind of work that you want to do doesn't mean that you're a good business person, and maybe you need to think about those business skills up front. And that was kind of his big lesson for my class. So the first thing to think about, or at least that I think about, is kind of understanding the relationship of your goals and your strategies and your tactics. And so in my case, I have a very broad range of skills that I pursue that support me. And so I do books that are, you know, more than half of my income. I part out those books in various ways. I take photographic assignment work. I do a variety of things. And so those are kind of strategies. I've had this strategy that I want to be able to do long-form journalism. I want to work in visual journalism, and I want to teach. And so that's my strategic plan to have the goal of, you know, being able to do the kind of work that I want to do and being financially viable. Tactics are very changeable, and there are ways of getting into that. For instance, if you decide that you want to teach, maybe you start to break into that by teaching a bunch of workshops for free so you get your name out there, or maybe you can adjunct, or maybe you want to get on with a university, but you need to get your chops up so you can get a relationship with a local community college or a local high school and fill in teaching there. That would be a tactic. I've decided that my tactic for this is going to be to start small in teaching and work up to the big job. You know, and there's a variety of tactics for any strategy that you might have. The thing that you need to do, and it's one of these things that you can do on the back of a napkin or with a legal tablet, is to go through and see if you can map your tactics so that they're supporting your strategies. In other words, you know, the kid that goes out, or my friend who goes and maxes out their credit cards buying a bunch of equipment for work that they ended up not getting, is not, you know, that hasn't been a very good tactic for them. You know, maybe a better tactic would be to wait till you get the assignment and buy the equipment when you have the assignment and have a couple long nights learning how to work it so that you're not making a bunch of investments up front that may not pay off. So when you talk about forming your strategy, think about, you know, what skills you bring to the board. So I work some in video now. And I knew that I had visual skills because I'd been a photographer and a picture editor for a really long time. What are my long-term goals? And when you think of your long-term goals, you need to think in terms of your long-term goals, both in the kind of work that you want to do, but where do you want to be 10 years from now financially? I'm at an age now where I really can't, you know, think, well, I'll figure out the finances later on, because eventually, you know, although probably none of us are ever going to retire now, I would like to at least pretend that I can retire. You know, how can I use my current skills to fill a need and make money? So that means you need to be able to look at the market, look at what's out there. You know, what are the opportunities in this field? It may be that there aren't many great opportunities in this field. You know, maybe that what you really want to do isn't going to be financially viable for you, and that requires a bit of market research to figure that out. You know, and then, you know, what new skills do I need to learn? And there's a lot of ways to go about doing that. And, you know, one of the advantages of being a freelancer that was, you know, kind of I was just reminded of is that You have the opportunity to learn new skills and to pursue different things. You can move into radio if you've decided that you want to work in radio. You can move into photography if you want to start, learning photography. Whereas in a staff job, I was very fortunate to work at a big newspaper that wasn't a guild paper, so it wasn't too controlling, and so I could work as a photographer and a writer. But a lot of newspapers, you have to do one or the other, particularly guild newspapers. If you're a writer, you actually can't put a picture into the paper. It's against union rules. Things are very staid. And so sometimes your opportunities are a little more limited if you're in a staff job. Then maybe your tactic would be that, okay, I can't do this in my staff job, but maybe I can start trying to sell photos on the side outside of my staff job as a freelancer. Or maybe I can develop a relationship with a local photographer and work as an assistant to them so I can learn these skills that I'm not going to be allowed to learn in, a more constrained situation. What equipment do I need? My advice from somebody whose work is incredibly equipment-oriented is to be really selective about this. And, we're susceptible, just like the consumer market is, to all of these cool new toys and bells and whistles that are out there. And, trust me, on any given day, there's $30,000 of lenses that I would just love to buy and play with. And the number of lenses that I've got now that I have purchased and invested money in that I have never published a photo that I took with. I've got some great photos that I really love with them, but nobody's bought them. And so if you actually were to go down to piece of equipment and then try to see how you paid for that piece of equipment, a lot of these have never paid for themselves. And then I've got other pieces of equipment that have paid for themselves 100 times over. And so when you're looking for how you need to invest in equipment, there's a lot of ways to go about making sure that you're making good investments. And that's not to say that you shouldn't buy the audio recorder or the lens that you think is going to be really inspiring for you to work with, even if those pictures just appear on your wall. But you should know that going in. You shouldn't be deluded that, oh my gosh, I'm going to go buy myself a 600 millimeter f4 for $12,000 because I'm going to get these awesome grizzly bear photos and go up to Alaska and do the story and get the grizzly bear photos and then find that the person that you're working for picks up the same photos for free off of Flickr from somebody who, is just out there doing it for fun. You're kind of self-sabotaging there. There are ways to go about doing that. One way is just to call other people that are in the field, and I think you'll find that whatever field you want to go into, be it documentary video or photography, the people are actually willing to share that, hey, I've made all these investments and here are the ones that have paid off for me. Here's what I usually shoot with. If you're a photographer, you can actually go to sites like Flickr and find people who you want to emulate with their work and find the pictures that have sold well or that you've seen in publications, and often there's data about what they used to make that picture in the file. Look it up. See what lenses they used and cameras they used, and figure out, what is going to be the kit for you that's going to be financially viable. And know when you're going in and buying equipment, whether you're buying equipment because this is actually going to pay for itself, this is the stuff that's going to get the job done, and when you're going in and buying equipment because this is going to be fun, this is something that I really want to work with, and, even if I don't sell anything that I shoot with this or that I record with this or that I paint with this, whatever, if you're an illustrator, you know that going in. So I'm doing this because this is for me. I'm buying this gear because this will make me money. This will actually get the job done and bring me a return. And then how do I get experience? And there are myriad ways of gaining experience in the different realms that you may want to work in. One I mentioned was, assist a photographer who you want to emulate or admire, or a videographer, or collaborate with somebody who's doing really well and has worked with other people in the realm that you want to work in. In other words, if you want to work in video and you're going to need to work with somebody that does audio, maybe you want to partner with somebody who does audio with other really good videographers and they can share what it's like to work with these people. I'll give you some advice. There's lots of workshops out there, and there are a lot of them that are, if not free, really close to free. The National Press Photographers Association, if you're a still photographer or a videographer that wants to work with DSLR cameras, which is a camera that looks like the big old still cameras that we have, but also shoot video, they have all kinds of free workshops. There's also lots of stuff online. And then, finding people to partner with that you can meet up with and spend time with while they work. Certainly, whenever I've had the opportunity, if I've had a student or somebody that's really wanting to get into something, that's wanted to come and work with me and help me hold a camera, haul gear, hold a boom mic for something that we're doing, you know, I'm more than happy to have them come along, and I'll share anything that I know with them, you know, in return for their assistance and easing my sore back. So these are just a couple of photos of mine more recently. I do a lot on fire, and so that's the fire in Colorado Springs last year, and the photo on the right is from the floods that just hit Boulder. I never really thought of myself as kind of a natural disaster journalist, but it kind of fell that way because I worked in news for a very long time, and I was the guy that was... that had bad enough judgment to always say, oh, you want to send me to a fire? Oh, you want me to train as a firefighter and go haul gear in the woods? Sure, I'll do that. Oh, there's a hurricane coming to Puerto Rico. Yeah, can I go early? Yeah, it's like that. The only time I've ever been to Puerto Rico is for hurricanes. And so I kind of realized that I had actually a skill set. And, you know, this is really just a specific example to me, but you can think in terms of a variety of things that you would do that would... require a specific set of skills and a specific set of equipment so that you think in advance so that you're prepared for these things when the assignments come down. And I can give you an example from, you know, from my work with wildfires that, you know, I'm red carded, but, you know, when I wasn't going to fight fires anymore, I bought my own fire retardant clothing, you know, just the green pants and the yellow shirt, and I had an old fire shelter that somebody gave me, and I put it into a bag so that when you showed up at a fire and the incident commanders or the people running it said, well, nobody's going to be able to do anything like this that doesn't have protective equipment and we can't provide it to you, I could just pull out my duffel bag and say, sure, let me change. If your freelance strategy, in my case, you know, and this is really a strategy that I fell into. This is just the kind of work that was coming my way, and I was interested in it, so I decided I should focus on this. I should be prepared for it. So if you really want to be, you know, the go-to person on, say, natural disasters, maybe you want to have a different cell phone contract and have it arranged in advance and have a cell phone that you can plug into your laptop so you can transmit. So that, A, when they're calling saying, hey, there's a flood in Boulder, yeah, we need something this afternoon, would you be willing to go wade out and make some photos for this or write a story about this? You're actually, wherever you are, you're going to get that call or you're going to get that email. You'll be able to transfer the data with an editor very quickly, but you'll also be able to move stuff with your phone off your laptop. You can just plug your phone into your laptop. That's an investment. That's an expense that you're going to have to incur. You don't want to make that investment if you don't think you're going to be doing that kind of work. But if you want to set yourself up for that kind of work, you need to have that already done. To give you an example, when Katrina hit, I was still in my staff job, but I had done a lot of work from the Himalaya, and I got calls from probably 7 or 8 journalist friends who wanted to go and cover Katrina, but because of all of the infrastructure problems down there, it was really difficult to file. And they couldn't get the assignment if they couldn't file, and they wanted to talk to me to see if I could loan them my internet beyond that I used from the Himalaya and my solar panels, which I couldn't because I'd already given them to another journalist who was going there. And they were all basically dealing with an organization, a company that I deal with that basically provides explorers with beyonds and solar panels, and they sold out almost immediately. And so a lot of these people just never got the job. They never got the assignment because they weren't equipped for it. They never had their beyond. They'd never been trained with it. They'd never, you know, worked with solar panels, worked in an environment like that. If you want to do that kind of work, you kind of need to have, if not have that kind of stuff that you own, have a relationship where you can make a call and say, hey, can you FedEx this stuff for me, or can I come by and pick this stuff up? And you also already need to have been trained on it. We're using an internet beyond. It's not that hard, but you kind of have to practice with it a little bit. And you don't want, I mean, you know, if you can't file that first story, you're not going to get the second story. Having your own emergency equipment. I mentioned, the Nomex clothes, but, fire boots, it depends on what you're covering. But having the clothing and the basic equipment of the people that work in that field that's going to allow you to get access. That works for you on a couple of different fronts. A, you can be safe. And, people that deal in emergencies, first and foremost want to make sure that they're not getting journalists killed because they know that that's going to get written about and they're not going to look good. As much as they don't want us there, they don't want us to not be there for that particular reason. And secondly, you look like you know what you're doing, even if you don't. You know, if you've got the Nomex clothing on and you've got your fire stuff there, you know, they're going to talk to you first. And they're going to take you more seriously, and you're going to be the first person they tap to get onto the bus that does the tour into the wildfire or into the flood or what have you. So so that's one. Purchasing a satellite modem, you know, these things are expensive. Maybe you don't have to purchase it. Maybe you can go in on it with some other journalists who are going to work on similar things but in different realms. So maybe, you know, the explorer or adventurer journalist wants to buy a Bagan and is willing to share the cost with you because you're in the same community, but you're going to do disasters, so it's unlikely that you're going to need it at the same time. Maybe there's a company you can rent it from. And in the case of video, audio, photographic world, there's all kinds of companies that have popped up that will rent stuff to you and deliver it to you same day or next day, you know, expensive lenses, all kinds of things like that. It's not just that you have that option, but you need to know that option, and you need to probably have a relationship with the company that does that if you're going to have to respond to these things as news. And then, you know, investing in specialized training. Now, that specialized training could be just working in your field, in your realm of journalism. But your specialized training could also be, say, going and getting Centurion training, which is a company that trains people to go to war zones, for journalists. Sebastian Younger, since the death of Tim Hetherington, one of the photojournalists that was killed in the Arab Spring, has started a fund and a foundation that just gives emergency medical training to journalists. So if you're going to a conflict zone, or if you're going to do stupid things in the Himalaya or what have you, maybe you apply to that organization so that you can go in and get the kind of first aid training that's going to make you more confident as a journalist when you're working there. And I think... So yeah, and I'm not a radio person, but I've been on radio enough where just kind of thought of some things, and you could apply this to anything. I'm just going down some examples here, but if your strategy is to expand into radio, I'd really like to do radio reporting. I'm in places where I know that there's going to be a market for radio reporting from me. Then some tactics might be creating an audio podcast on your website so that, you know, when you're trying to sell a story, you can say, hey, and I've been doing this audio stuff on my website, and I've gotten pretty good at it. If you'd like to listen to it, here's a link. Volunteering at a local public radio or community radio station. I know that's worked for at least one person in the room here, where, you know, you can go and start your own radio show, volunteer at your local radio station, so you've got the chops from working with some other professionals. Maybe you want to gather audio clips for somebody that's doing an oral history. When I was covering fisheries in Connecticut, New England, they were doing a big oral history at Mystic Seaport, and it just happened while I was working on other stories, I was able to sit in with the person that was recording these things and learn a little bit about how they do things, and that was really helpful to me. Script writing for radio or television news or science programs. I know other people that have really gotten into that because they want to keep writing rather than doing the technical stuff, but writing for radio and writing for TV is very different than writing for print. So, you know, that's a way to gain a little bit of experience. And we've kind of covered the personal equipment and training. And I think this is you.
That's fine. good time to change. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about, kind of money. You know, I'm going to look at the profit arm of things a little bit, and we'll talk a bit about money here. One of the things as you're thinking about strategies, you know, you got to look at the profit leg of all of this, and, you know, piggybacking on some of what Michael was talking about in terms of, you know, the investments that you put into particular types of work. I mean, part of it is, you know, you need to know how much money up front are you going to have to invest in what you're trying to do, and maybe it's as simple as, you know, you need your computer and your recorder and your phone and you're fine. So, but even that is, you know, is a cost of doing business. So you really need to have an idea of, okay, what are my business expenses? The other thing to, you know, get a handle on is, you know, for whatever you're doing, you know, if you're doing radio work, if you're doing multimedia work, if you're doing print work, online work, you want to have an idea of, okay, what can I expect to earn for whatever I'm trying to do, so that you know, have an idea of, okay, what could potentially come in from the investment of time and resources that I'm doing. And particularly if you're launching into some new strategy, if you're trying to learn something new, you want to break into a new beat, a different type of work, you need to have an idea of, there may be a ramp up time where you're trying, you know, the time period where you're, you know, you're if I mean, I'm in a phase right now where I'm, you know, I would like to do more narrative journalism, and that means that I have to do some pitching, and it's going to take some time for those pitches to land. And so I have to think a bit about, okay, it may take some time before I'm making money off of, you know, these sorts of projects, just because that's you know, it's going to take time for me to, you know, develop the story, send the pitches out, and for them to find a home. And in a broader strategy, you know, if you're trying to work your way into radio, or you want to become a radio host, or you have a goal of, you know, working on a documentary or something, you want to have an idea of what that timeline is going to take to get to, you know, to reach that, you know, career satisfaction goal. I mean, what are those benchmarks? What are those achievements that you want to reach? You know, your book project, whatever. And, you know, one issue to think, and that all comes down to this, you know, cost of doing business. And, you know, there are calculators for figuring this out. But, you know, as you're thinking about these strategies and tactics, you know, the equipment, the time, all of these things that you need to think about. And this is from the National Press Photographers Association website. This is something that Michael pulled off there, but there are calculators where you can basically go through and categorize, okay, what are my expenses? And you're thinking about mundane things here. I mean, we're talking about, you know, not just, you know, equipment and, you know, fancy, flashy stuff. I mean, we're talking about health insurance, taxes, the money you want to stick into your retirement fund. All of these things have to be part of, you know, your calculation. I mean, and some of this is thinking, and I think one point that probably we haven't made, but I think is an important point to make, is I really think about my freelance business as part of an overall life strategy. And I think a lot of times, and I think because, you know, to some extent you're often working independently, you might be working from home, there's a way in which your life and your business really, really dovetail. And I mean, as an example, you know, I mentioned a little bit earlier that, you know, that that I was freelancing while my husband was in graduate school. Well, and he is now, I mean, what brought us to Chattanooga is that he is a tenure track on the faculty here at University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and that was what brought us to Chattanooga. And one of the things, as I thought about freelancing, was the flexibility that that would allow me, knowing that he was an academic, and knowing that that would allow me to move and take my career wherever I wanted to go. That basically, it was a way for us to, you know, to both have satisfying careers and to solve the two-body problem of, you know, where are we going to live? So just as an overall, I mean, that's a little bit of a tangent, but it's part, but the life and the money and the business kind of all go together here. And one thing that I will tell you in terms of, I've put a cover of this book called The Money Book. You can't probably see the whole title. It's called The Money Book, for Freelancers, Part-Timers, and the Self-Employed. And it's by Joseph D'Agnese and Denise Kiernan. And if you haven't seen this book, I really feel like it's sort of the Bible of freelance money. The authors are freelance writers, so they know exactly where we are. It's geared toward anybody who runs an independent business or has irregular income of any kind. But the thing I will tell you is that, I picked up this book in 2010, and it came out in 2010. But, you know, that was the depth of the recession. I started freelancing at the beginning of my career in, you know, 2004, 2005. And, you know, that was a rough time. I mean, and part of it was that, you know, money started to feel very much out of control. A lot of the stuff that's in this book is common sense, but it's really, really useful in terms of thinking about how you manage your money, how you deal with your expenses, how you get real about making the freelance funding work with your life. And one of the things that I will say in terms of that's really kind of the core principle of this book is really that you skim off, I mean, when you receive a check, whether it's a $300 check or a $3,000 check or a, you know, $10,000 check, that you think about it in terms of percentages, and you skim off percentages for your taxes, your retirement, for everything else. But one piece that I'm highlighting here is, you need to skim off a percentage that goes back into your business, whether that's for the computer that you're going to need to replace next year, for your office supplies, for, you know, to save to come to conferences like this one, for whatever professional development you want to do. It's really important to think about, I mean, you can get grant, you know, you might be able to get grant money, you might be able to get a fellowship to go to a conference, but if you have a fund that you can draw on, you have an idea of, oh, I can afford to go to this conference, oh, I can afford to replace my computer next year, oh, I would really like to get involved in doing multimedia journalism and I might want to buy this equipment, you're not necessarily dependent on, you know, did I get the grant funding to make those opportunities possible. You have a little bit more control if you've got money socked away. And obviously a corollary to that is you may be able to find a grant that's going to help you with, you know, one of those projects. But if you have sort of, this is my, you know, this is my work money, you know that, okay, I can pull this out and I can, you know, I can go to this meeting. I can, you know, my computer is dying. I can replace it. And then I think now we'll head over to fellowships and grants a little bit.
So one thing that, when we talk about advanced freelancing and we kind of think in terms of freelancing as this linear thing and you start out and you're a beginner and you're pitching and then you're going to be an advanced freelancer and it's kind of this, you know, linear advance. And I don't really see it like that. I actually see it as this big sphere and that we're in different parts of the sphere so that, you know, there's all different types of skills that you're going to bring to bear and you're going to develop different amounts of expertise with different ones. And you kind of need to know, this is before we get to fellowships and grants, but you need to know the economics of the different realms that you're going to work with and understand that the business models are going to be different for them. So when you get back to the cost of doing business calculator, I did that right when I went freelance, and then I would do that once a year for the first 3 years until it just got too depressing. But going through it, because I was changing. I was changing what I was doing. You know, I initially was working on writing magazine stories and selling a few photos with them, and then the next year I was getting more photo assignment work, and I was having more difficulty selling large magazine stories, and the economics are very different there. To give an example, I work a lot in video now as well as still photography. In still photography, it is really important to learn about digital asset management. It really is in all of these things, but particularly still photography. You have to maintain your copyright, or you're not leaving money on the table. You're taking your money out of your wallet, you're putting it on the table, and you're pushing it over onto the other side of the table, and you're not even pushing it at anybody in particular. You're pushing it over to the other side of the table and turning around and say, whoever wants it can take it. And it really is that way. It's a really difficult realm to make a job in photojournalism right now. And so you need to maintain your copyright. You need to have good, solid contracts with the people that you're selling images to. You need to be managing that. You need to, you know, allow for a certain amount of time to follow up on the people that rip you off and send them notes to either take this down off your website or pay me or, you know, whatever needs to be done. And so I've had a client that was a major magazine that took 11 months to pay me. And this is for photos and pictures. And so the next time they called with an assignment, I had a conversation with them. They made me an offer, and I said, okay, I'm adding 15% to your offer because you took so long to pay me before that I have to allow for about 25 hours to hound you to pay me. And so I need to actually add that into the cost. And I didn't get the assignment, but it actually works in photography, where there's a great book, if you actually are really interested in the economics of just the still photography side, called Best Business Practices for Photographers. It's worth it to read it for anybody. It's just really good business practices. And one of the things that the author, John Harrington, who's a very successful Washington, D.C. photojournalist, does is when he delivers, he actually pads in 15% for administrative costs. The administrative costs are what it costs him or his staff to bother people to pay them. But if you pay within 30 days, he gives you a 15% discount. And so the people that see his bids, and he's very clever at how he writes these things, just see the, if you pay within 30 days, I'll give you a 15% discount. And suddenly all these clients that were taking nearly a year to pay him were paying within 30 days because they wanted to save that money. So there's a lot of tricks that you can do like that. That works with still photography. With video, it doesn't work that way. You don't have, the video doesn't really have the resale value that still photography does, very rarely. So you're not protecting your, you want to protect your copyright, but you don't have all these stock sales that might come around to you. When you sign a still photography contract, if you're really good at it, then you're getting paid both your creative fee to go and make the photograph, and you're getting paid a usage fee. And you get paid a usage fee every time it gets used. So if you're dealing with a publication and they're going to put it in print and they're going to put it on the web, that's two usage fees, and you'll have two different levels for that. If they're going to republish it later, that's another usage fee. You don't get any of that with video, and so you need to make sure that you're getting paid everything you're going to make on a video right when you do the video. Whereas with a still photograph, because you maintain your copyright and you're making a portrait of Paul Newman and he's close to death and you know this picture is just going to sell and sell and sell and sell and sell, you may not need to make as much money up front on the assignment because you know you're going to get a bunch of sales after the fact. But with video, that's rarely the case. So you need to know going in that I really have to get paid what I'm going to make on this when I'm out doing the video. That's just one example. But knowing the various economics and legal rules and the way things work with the market and the various realms you want to work in makes it more likely that you're not going to lose money as you expand into these things. We've talked a little bit about grants. I'll reemphasize that finding fiscal sponsors opens up a huge realm of grant money that's just not available to you as an individual, and it's not that hard. There are lots of, pretty much any nonprofit can be your fiscal sponsor, but there are also nonprofits out there that are just there to be fiscal sponsors for the kind of projects we want to do. One that I've dealt with is called the Blue Earth Alliance. I think Bear's dealt with them too. And they basically are just, what they do is you pitch them a project that you want to do. They work on visual projects generally dealing with the environment or social justice. And if they like your project, they bring it under their 501c3 umbrella. They take a certain percentage of the money that you're given from grants, but then they help you reach out to all these organizations that will only give money to an organization. So you suddenly have opened up a universe of funding to you. There are all kinds of other fellowships available to you. I'll talk about the Scripps Fellowship because that's kind of what pays my salary now, and it's the one that I'm most beloved of. But if you just go online and you actually look, it's like most of us think in terms of three or four things. I just went to one site, and that was the list of fellowships and grants available to journalists. So, be creative. The other thing to think about is that there are lots of fellowships and grants out there that aren't necessarily aimed at journalists, but that might be aimed at you. For instance, there's lots of grant money available for regions. So maybe in Southeast Asia you have a project you want to do. There's not a granting organization that's focused on journalists that you can get money from, but there may be a development organization that's working in that realm that might be able to provide you with some funding. So, think broadly and be really creative in who you approach. Here are a number of places that you can click on, but certainly urge you to explore a variety of places. You write to journalismjobs.com, has a long list of fellowships and grants. So on the fellowship realm, the Scripps Fellowships is 9 months at the University of Colorado in Boulder. It's a project-based fellowship, and if you get it, it was in my case my dream year, and that's where I started the current project I'm doing now on wildfires, which has gone on and on and on. There are a variety of ways to approach these. For one thing, know what the fellowship's goal is. Some are project-based. Some want you to be trying to produce a single piece of work out of this and want to assist you in doing that. Some are just there to make you smart. And that, you don't have to pitch a project to them at all. I believe the Niemans are like that at Harvard. You just get to do all kinds of cool things. And, you don't have to be aiming for any particular thing when you get out of there. The other thing, even when you're on a project-based fellowship, and somebody's going to reach out of my computer and dope slap me for saying this, but you can change your project. You know, it's like, you know, maybe half of the projects that I know of that have been done for fellowships ended up not getting done, and they went on and did something else. News broke. You know, something came up. They used the first semester to research something and decided it wasn't that great a story, but I met this professor or this researcher doing this. And you can change tracks. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the rule we had when I was back in news, which was, you know, you don't have to go and do the story that you're assigned so long as you bring back a better story. So, you know, you can be creative about, you know, changing tracks, finding other things to do. First thing to do is, you know, read anything you can find that former fellows have produced, what they've written about it, everything that you can, and research it. There's a variety of reasons for doing that. One is that you gain a sense of the taste of the program and the university or the organization. The other thing is that there's a lot of things that they aren't going to say up front. So, you know, for example, I applied for a grant a number of times with an organization and didn't get it and was really surprised I wasn't getting it. So I went through and I read much more carefully what everybody else had done there. And I discovered that they had not given a grant to anybody over 40 years old in like 8 years. Now, they didn't say anything about wanting to support young journalists, and I don't have any problem with them supporting young journalists, but I wish I'd known that going in. And so that's something you can avoid if you read really carefully. You know, there's others that talk about, you know, that are focused on international journalism broadly. But if you actually read through what everybody has done there, you might find that almost all of their work is in the developing world. So maybe you don't want to pitch a story to them that's funded in France because it's not necessarily going to be a good fit. So hitting the ground running is, you know, once you think you've got the right program and all, I think help yourself if you are producing stuff along the line of what you're saying you're going to do there. So, you know, the fact that I had worked as a U.S. Forest Fire or a U.S. Forest Service firefighter, that I was producing content based on the project that I wanted to do, and then some stories that weren't on the same topic but were similarly structured to what I was proposing, kind of gave them a sense that I had the chops to do what I said I wanted to do and that I was really serious about it. I think it's frustrating for some of these organizations when they see a good idea come in from somebody that is entirely different from another good idea that they pitched before. And it's almost like, you know, they can, you know, we can tell when, you know, you're just throwing stuff at the wall to see what's going to stick. They, you know, we ideally want somebody that's really committed to the idea that they're proposing. once you're in, you want to keep your chops up while you learn new skills. This is something that I found really difficult, is that it's really easy to get, oh, wow, I've got a year at a university to do whatever I want. I'm putting the cameras down, and I'm actually not going to write anything while I'm here. I'm just going to do my research, and then you get to the end of it, and it's like, oh, my God, how do I work this thing? You know, I've done all this research for it, and now it's time to go out and do the work, and I've forgotten, you know, the basic skills that I came in with. And then know if you want support for a specific project, if you just want to get smarter about, say, energy, or if you want both. So that you're making that clear. So I have a bunch of friends that have done the Knight Fellowship at Stanford, and I had an opportunity to sit around with some of the people that were involved in selecting fellows for that. And it'll be my one vulgarity of the night, which was, you know, I asked, so, you know, how do you determine this? It's really hard. You know, this is like one of the most popular fellowships. There's so many people applying. You know, how do you figure out who you're going to bring in? You know, you have all these great people, and you're trying to be really diverse and have young people and older people and people that nobody has ever heard of mixed with people that are really famous and have accomplished all these things. And the guy said, you know, the first thing we look for is we really don't want assholes. But he expanded on that, and that, you know, they're kind of setting you up. You know, they've got funding to create a year of magic for journalism. They believe in what we do, and they want people to bring magic. They want, you know, we want people that are really engaged with our program. We want people that are going to connect with one another while they're in the program and collaborate and go out and do things together. And they really want this to be this really incredible creative environment. So I think it's really helpful if they. If they see that you know you're really excited about being there, you want to bring a lot to the program. You're getting your year to be, say, the big person on campus, and you're really going to take advantage of that. We've kind of covered grants in the earlier ones, so we could probably move on. So now I've kind of covered this a little bit too. So now it's yours.
Okay. This is actually sort of a corollary to some of what I was talking about with the money, but there's also the time investment in your business. And I mean, one of the things to think about, I was talking a bit about, you know, skimming money off of every paycheck to help fund yourself. I also think you have to think a little bit about skimming time. I mean, and whatever new skills you want to learn, you have to, you know, find the time to learn those skills. You know, and whether that's, a formal, whether you're taking a course, whether that's a workshop, or you're just learning those skills on your own. And so one of the examples I'll give you is, I mean, I tend to think about these things as part of my business plan, which is, I try to, basically create something every year that, kind of has goals and, where I want to be, the kinds of things I want to be doing. And as an example, one of the things I decided in 2009 was, I really should be, I really should know how to blog. I mean, that's something I need to know how to do. And that was when I really said, okay, this year I'm going to set up a blog and I'm going to blog. That was also when I got on Twitter. So I'm not saying that needs to be a resolution, but one of the things you can do is you can kind of think of it as, whenever you sort of formally kind of create, as you're thinking about strategies and tactics and new things that you want to pursue, set yourself a timeline. And so for me, 2009 was the year of the blog. I set up my own blog. It's still operating, and it's still a part of my online presence and how I present myself to the world. But whether that's photography, multimedia, whatever you're thinking, or if you're trying to cultivate a new beat, and I think the thing with those types of investments is to try not to get too ambitious in any single year. I mean, I would say make it something that's manageable. You'll like starting a blog, or I want to cultivate X new beat. I want to I specifically want to be writing about urban sustainability, and that's a beat that I want to cultivate, and that's something that I'm going to cultivate in this year. If you get too ambitious, then you're spread a little thin. But targeting that and saying, okay, 2014 will be the year of, can be sort of a tool that you can use. And I think this was actually you. Do you want to talk about this a little bit? But I mean, I guess I could. Okay. One of the things in terms of, I mean, I think Michael and I are both examples of people who have used a lot of different skills and strategies to build our career, and I can run through this. I mean, if you focus on one thing, there are certain advantages and disadvantages. You can be more productive if you're doing one thing. I mean, if you are primarily focusing on writing for online outlets, I mean, you're very focused. You're not having to go in many different directions. You're not having to shift gears as often, and that does take some time. You can also develop a skill set. Sometimes it can be easier to raise your rates if you're known as the person who does this, this thing and does it really well. The only thing is, if suddenly the market is not interested in that one skill set, you can really, I mean, instead of being, you can think of this like a financial portfolio. If all of your, if all of your eggs are in one basket and that basket tanks, you're in trouble. And the other thing is that at some point you may be limited in the way that, in the ways that you can grow. So it's always good to be thinking both about how that's going to affect you economically and how it's going to affect you in terms of, the kinds of, career progression you want to have over time. And so the idea, as Michael and I were talking about this session, was to think about freelancing as that we each have a quiver of skills, that there are arrows in our quiver, And really, and I think the core point that we wanted to make is that every quiver is going to be different. What works for me, what works for Michael, what works for any individual person in this room is not going to be the same, because we're all coming at this from different places. We have different skills, different interests, different passions. So part of it is, if you're thinking about a quiver, is, you know, some of those questions we were asking earlier, you know, both where you want to go and also what you bring to the table as you're thinking about the quiver, and then the additional arrows that you're going to add to the quiver as you go. And really what we sort of wanted to do was talk a little bit about each of us as, you know, case studies and what our quivers look like.
So, these are just photos from the last year or so that various people had taken. So, you know, me working on a video, me doing a strange radio interview where I had to talk into two phones at once, and just doing an interview for a print story. And I'll talk about how you can kind of combine these things. No, you know, as you said, no two portfolios are going to be the same. In my case, I try to mix long-term, medium-term, and short-term projects so that you've got some shorter-term things that are bringing in a little bit of income now and again. You've got a long-term thing. In my case, it's usually a book, and often that's a 4 or 5 year project. And, you know, book advances kind of come in, you know, in chunks, and you can plan on them. Allowing that you're producing things, you know, roughly on the schedule that you planned on, but you're going to get a chunk of whatever, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, and then you're not going to see any more money from that project for maybe a year or 18 months. So you need to figure out how you're going to break that up, how you're going to use that. and then I found that if you're clever, you can balance this portfolio so that some things are up when other things are down. For instance, when I was strictly freelancing, I took some assignments as a photographer at energy conferences where they just want a bunch of pictures of people with their energy equipment and things like that. I felt as though it got me around the ethics issue that I couldn't really go there and be writing promotional material, but I could just be producing photos. And those often came to me when I wasn't getting much work elsewhere. I've actually kind of have a feeling that sometimes when the editorial clients aren't really biting, the other organizations are actually funding things because they need to do more outreach. And that was really valuable to me because I would make these photos, but I also would do a lot of reporting while I was there, just looking for story ideas that I could do as a journalist after this was all done, you know, because the photography, portraits of people with their inventions really didn't compromise me on actually reporting on this outside of that later on. And then, you know, repurposing materials and intellectual capital between your fields. So I was 25 years on a newspaper staff, and I started as a photojournalist. I always wrote, and then I was writing my own stories, and then I was a picture editor and a photographer and a writer simultaneously, and kind of doing one big book or one big project at the paper a year that I would shoot and write and edit. And then started doing books while I was on staff. I took a buyout and was freelancing. I got my Scripps Fellowship. And then, you know, as of this summer, got the job in the actual center. And so I've got this breakdown of things that I do, all of which are, you know, kind of rising and falling at different times. Teaching makes up a much bigger portion of my quiver now than it did a year ago and more than it did 2 years ago. Actual pitching and assignment work for magazines is very rare for me now. I probably say no to like 80% of the things that come my way. And it's not that I'm great or anything like that. It's just I've got a lot of stuff that I like doing. And, if rates aren't, you know, worth my while, I generally don't do them unless it's someplace I really like working for. I'll briefly talk about, you know, kind of my philosophy, which I've come to call using the whole animal, in the sense that, you know, the Native Americans, when they'd kill something, you know, nothing was wasted, you know, right down to the bone marrow. So I've got my last book was on crime on Mount Everest, and so I made a couple of trips up Mount Everest and spent a lot of time in the Himalaya reporting this, and it started out as a series of newspaper stories, and then that built into a magazine story and then into this big investigative book that took me back there a few times. And portions of that book, as I was doing it, I would sell as magazine pieces or news stories. So I'm actually selling what's going to be in the book as a story before it comes out, or simultaneous with it coming out, you need to have that relationship with your publisher. Some publishers don't like it. In my case, they really liked it because it built a lot of enthusiasm for the topic, and it built what they call a platform for me. Then news photos and things that I took while I was there that appeared elsewhere, I could sell. And dropped off a little bit, although I have one sale going on right now. So other publications would call me, and they wouldn't be interested in the story or with my book, but they were interested in some of my photos, or can we see your stuff? So I'd get a little bit of sales off of that, and that was a little bit of money. I had audio and video that we shot while we were there that went into TV news programs. I just had a piece. This has kind of been the gift that keeps on giving. The book came out in 2008, and I just had a piece I was a part of for Dateline. I don't get paid for the piece for Dateline, but I get paid if people buy photos and video from me for projects like that. And also, again, it builds a lot of enthusiasm. It sells more books. The publisher likes that. You know, some of the media appearances led to, you know, other printings of the book. So it helps. I do a big multimedia photo, video, lecture, slideshow, which started out as a book talk, so you're not getting paid for that. The publisher's sending you around to do that. People saw that, called. Year later, I'm doing it, and I'm getting paid for it. So, it's not great money, but it's a little bit here and there. And then that book, draws assignments on its topic. I actually, when the book came out, got assignments from a number of different places, both domestically and overseas. I actually wrote a very long magazine piece for the biggest newspaper in Germany, and I don't speak a word of German, so I actually have no idea what I said. I'm assuming they translated me really well. But that was a really good, pretty well-paying gig. And then through that, it leads to a lot more excitement about the topic. And then, I went back and revisited another story that I'd done at the newspaper on fire. And the next thing you know, you're in another book, and I'm doing basically the same thing, where I'm researching the book, I'm reporting this book, and through that, various pieces of that I can sell while I'm doing it. And I kind of covered getting teaching into this earlier on, so we'll move on.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a little bit about me. I'm probably a little bit unusual for this room in that I was actually a working scientist in the middle of a PhD and said, "Ooh, I don't know that I want to be in the lab forever." And so science journalism grabbed me. I ended up taking a science journalism course and I did complete my PhD. But immediately went to New York and did two internships. And then I wanted to stay in New York and didn't have a full-time job. So I basically became a freelancer, and this was in 2004. One of the things that is a piece of all of this is that I actually worked on staff at a science museum while I was finishing up my PhD. That was part of my, okay, well, what am I going to do with this science thing that I like? And because I'm interested in communicating with the public, I basically was thinking to myself, okay, I want to be a journalist or an informal science educator or something. But those two experiences, basically, I moved to New York. I was an intern at Discover, and then I was a AAAS Mass Media Fellow at WNBC-TV before freelancing. And basically what I wanted to give you was kind of the roadmap of how somebody like me ended up where I am basically 9 years later. And so I'm going to give you sort of the three pieces that I came into my career with. So I had this chemistry PhD. So I have this knowledge of, I have this deep knowledge of chemistry. I'm also, I was working in science journalism. I took a graduate level course in science journalism, and I did these two internships. So I was launching a journalism career, and then I had this experience working as an informal educator in a hands-on science museum. And I'll kind of tell you a little bit about how all of that played out. So, the chemistry PhD has led to certain things. I do a certain amount of, technical editing for a chemistry journal because I have that knowledge. And I also have the WordCraft. So I can basically, that's a revenue stream for me that comes to me. I don't have to pitch for it, but it's a nice little regular bit of money that helps me. This combination of the chemistry PhD and being a journalist means that you know, people will come to me to cover chemistry topics. At one point, I was never a staffer, I did about a 6-month fill-in covering chemistry for Science News at one point, because, you know, I knew someone, I knew they needed someone. They weren't, at the time, they were willing to consider, I was working in New York, they were in Washington, but I was able to cover chemistry news for Science News. And really that came out of having both of those, both of those skill sets. And that was, that was in 2007 that I did some of that work. The other thing that kind of happened here, that sort of where the Science Museum and journalism came together, is I was working in a hands-on science museum. And while I was at the hands-on science museum, they had an educational newspaper for, articles that they did for kids. So I did a little bit of that, but it was connected with my work at the Science Museum. But that then allowed me to start covering science for kids' publications. So I've written for Scholastic, National Geographic Kids, Science News for Kids. So I cover, I'm able to cover science for kids, as well as for a scientific audience, as well as for a general audience. And that's really a core part of how I do things. I really think about covering the topics I cover for a really, disparate audience. The other thing that kind of happened, and this was really sort of a fluke, but it was a very happy fluke. While I was in New York and I was deciding to freelance, I ended up applying for a job with a graphic design firm, and they were working on the astronomy exhibits at Griffith Observatory. And I initially applied for the job as a writer. They were looking for a writer, and I had covered some astronomy stories while I was at Discover as an intern, and I said, I could do that. and applied for this job. They ended up hiring a more experienced astronomy writer, but they were interested in me because I had the science museum background, because I had the journalism background. And what I ended up doing actually was talking to a lot of scientists and providing the content that the writer then turned into exhibits. I did it 4 days a week. It was a great way to have a set of, it was a nice steady income that I had for almost a year that helped me to get a freelance career launched. So, it was great serendipity that all of this worked together. I'm now doing some freelance editing that comes out of some of the journalism work that I've done. And then the other thing, I mentioned earlier that one of the things that was involved in the exhibit project was that I was managing a research team. Okay, I'm wrapping up. I was managing a research team, and I really like project management, sort of ironically, for being a freelancer who mostly works from my office on my own. And so as the team of us were working on the Science Writer's Handbook, I talked about how 2009 had been my year of the blog and building the web and social media skills, and I like project management. And so it was sort of a natural fit for me to then start, think about, being the project manager for the website for this book. So, that's just sort of a map of, how things happened to me. Some of that was opportunities that came my way. Some of it was things that I was, prepared for because of various experiences that I had. And I really think that at this point we can sort of wrap up and take any questions that you have for us.
I think this actually applies to both of you, because you both moved after living somewhere for a long time. And I want to know, was it hard to do that? And how did it affect your work? Because, Michael, you were in Hartford for a really long time, and now you're in a totally different place. It seems to actually have helped you a lot. Maybe, I don't know if with a new perspective, new place, whether that was really a good thing.
First of all, my thanks to to Cindy Scripps and CU for bringing me in as a fellow. And we weren't sure we would stay in Boulder, but, I'm a climber. I used to go to Boulder on vacation, once or twice a year for, probably the better part of a decade, years ago. And then suddenly I was living in a cabin in a park 7 minutes from my office. I rode my bike. I had no obligations except to do my research. So it was pretty hard to think I'm going to go back to Hartford, where the media landscape is, yeah, where basically, you know, every 3 months I was getting a note about friends that were getting laid off from the paper and how hard it was to make a freelance living. And I think, you know, my decision was that if I'm going to go bankrupt in journalism, I want to do it in a really pretty place with a long history of panhandling. So it worked out really well. We weren't sure we were going to stay, but everything kind of fell into place.
And obviously, I mean, to some extent, the move was somewhat governed by my husband's career, not necessarily mine. But I actually see this as a really, I mean, we've been here about a year, and I'm still in a little bit of a transition out of work strategies. And so there are certain things I'm definitely going to learn as the day goes on today. But one of the things, I mean, and I was living in New York City, and now I live in Chattanooga. And the thing about that I always felt like in New York City was that you have to think about your freelance career differently if you live in a major media center than if you live outside a major media center. I mean, I feel like when I lived in New York, I felt like I was never going to sell a local story. I mean, let's face it. I lived in Brooklyn. How many writers are there in Brooklyn? Am I ever going to sell a local story? Probably not. And if you live in a major media center, I think you have to think about your career differently than if you live somewhere else, because you have, I mean, now I feel like I can use the fact that I live in Chattanooga in the Southeast to my advantage. I mean, I think if you live outside a major media center, you can start to think about what are the local stories, what are the regional stories that might have national implications. And I'm still, you know, I'm still making that transition. But I really think, I mean, that's part of some of the work-life issues that you have to think about. Depending on where you live, there's really a different sort of story strategy you can pursue. In terms of the practical stuff, I actually really only—I did some meeting reports for a client in New York, and that's the only client I lost in making the move, because I couldn't go to their meetings anymore since I don't live in New York.
Say one other thing to that, which was, I think one of the skills that we have, particularly if you work in science or environment issues, and one of the things that it was hardest for me to have confidence about was our skill set is that we see the future to some degree. And that you're going in and you're trying to pitch trends, and if you're really on top of it, you're pitching trends that editors, you know, don't see as trends yet. You know, you're kind of ahead of the curve. And, on my, you know, move to Boulder, it was really helpful to me that we have a really great community of journalists and science journalists and photojournalists and documentary makers who are like-minded. And so I felt as though I was in a community that, you know, when I was pitching this project about, you know, wildfire, whatever, 4 or 5 years ago, and a lot of editors in New York who I had a lot of dealings with were like, who cares about that? You know, I had a group of people that said, no, that's a great idea, stick with it. And that was really, really helpful. And, you know, I have tons of friends back east still in New York and Connecticut, and I really miss them. But, you know, being in, you know, a rather depressed media landscape there was just a, you know, a sense of, you know, particularly having taken a buyout and all these other colleagues of mine that had been laid off, where, you know, you're just getting together with people for coffee or lunch, you know, because suddenly you have time in the middle of the day. And there was, you know, a sense, you know, of a lot of us that, you know, there were just a lot of beaten dogs. There were just a lot of people that had kind of lost the faith. And so moving to another landscape and connecting with a bunch of new people was really helpful to me, just in that even though there's just as much struggle in Boulder or more, there's more competition, there was also just a really good attitude, and got in with a, you know, kind of a core of people that were interested in similar things and really encouraging and, you know, really interested in collaborating to kind of overcome what's going on in the media world. And that was really helpful to me.
Yeah, I just had a question on that topic, on how you balance, you know, being like the only reporter in your small town in Western Colorado, or, you know, one of the few science journalists in Chattanooga, and that uniqueness with then there not being that much of a market for stories from that area, like how you can sort of work that by saying, like, I'm here and I can do this and there's not very many other people here, and then editors say, but we don't want that many stories about you know, whatever backwater you live in. So how do you figure that out?
I think in my case, it's kind of, I'm very topic associated. So, you know, there's various issues that people associate me with, and my market is really not, you know, local at all, although I've done some stuff for the Denver Post and, you know, some other regional magazines. So, there will be a backlash from this because it's happened to me before because I'm associated with one thing that's going on a lot right now and I've got more than enough work on that particular topic. And then when that's no longer a fad, I'll be pounding the pavement again. But I think, kind of like Dan, you know, if you can associate yourself with a topic and you're known, you know, all over the place for knowing this topic and stay connected with some people, I find that's really helpful.
And I think the answer is I'm still figuring that out. I mean, I don't think I have an answer to that question, but I think I've spent so many years on the other end. I mean, I've spent so many years on the other end where I was like, you know, I would really love to do a local story when that was just not going to be feasible. I think what I'm trying to do, and we'll see how it plays out, is, you know, basically just trying to read as much as I can and really think about themes and think about, okay, well, what are issues that I see here of which where my area is a case study for this big problem, and that's the way I'm approaching it. Now, whether that'll pan out, we'll see.
So I have a question about the quiver concept and diverse revenue streams. Can you half-ass it? Like, how, if I'm a writer and all I do is write, and I want to diversify and maybe sell some photographs or something, I mean, is it possible to half-ass that or half-ass the social media stuff? How can I get kind of competent and then sell a couple of photos? Or do I have to really invest a lot of time to learn how to make videos and like go off and do like a 6-month fellowship and have it become a core part of my business? So can you comment on half-assing?
I'm an expert. You finally found my panel. The reality is no, I wouldn't think of it as half-assing. I think that there's levels of commitment. And so, yeah, you totally can. I mean, Hillary Rossner, who is, you know, a friend of many of ours here, a great science writer, and she had a piece that she wrote, and they called, and she had just taken, like, a cell phone photo of her subject, and she had another magazine call and say, hey, we'd like to use your photo with a profile of this person, and I don't think she made very much money on it. But so, you know, it depends on what you want to do. So if you're somebody that interviews a lot of people, you know, learning how to make just a basic headshot, which doesn't take a heck of a lot of skill or a heck of a lot of equipment, you know, just a basic camera and a little bit of practice and training, that, you know, and then just make a headshot of everybody that you interview. And you can always add that on. You know, and say, hey, I've also got a good photograph, or maybe even include a low res that they can't steal from you, to prove that you've got a good photograph of it. And, you know, you probably won't make a ton of money on that, but it's a way to, you know, put a little bit of icing on top of the cake. You know, if you happen to be somebody that's reporting from really difficult to get locations, it's probably worth your while to at least learn the basics of photography so that you can make landscapes or scenes from where you're at and have those to sell. As you get to, you know, more advanced levels of photojournalism or video, then it really does take a commitment. Not, you know, to be honest, I, the equipment thing is just, you know, that's eye candy. It's, you know, it's kind of sad for me when I'm teaching photojournalism how many kids are fascinated by the cameras and by all this gear, but, you know, don't really develop the relationships and all to make really good photos. You know, Henri Cartier-Bresson shot his entire career with a camera and one lens. You know, you can actually make great photos with a very limited kit. So the investment that you should make is in training and practicing and shooting. But at that level, you have to love what you're doing in the same way that you love writing or whatever you do now, you know, because you're just not going to, you know, stick with something if you're not enjoying the time that you're putting into it. Does that answer your question?
I'll just comment a little bit on web and social media stuff, because I think that stuff can start to feel overwhelming. And And I think, you know, some of the things you were talking about with photography, I think, also apply there. I mean, and I guess what I think of in terms of web and social media stuff is it's about, I think of it a little bit like learning a language. And yes, there are people who are going to be, you know, fluent in social media and or you know, web development or whatever else. And as much web stuff as I've done, you know, and in terms of coding, I am not, you know, I am not a coder, and that's one of the things I know about myself. I mean, I can tell you right now, for example, if you look at the Science Writers Handbook website, we hired a web designer because that was not something that any of us had the core skill set and wanted to do. I mean, and that's the other thing is think about what you really want to do. I mean, I'm a content person. I mean, pure and simple. I'm, you know, and so I think if you're thinking about doing what I mean, I think the thing with social media is I think increasingly it's a good idea to be conversationally fluent. I mean, you know, I don't speak conversational Spanish. I'd like to. but I do speak German. So so that's why the language concept works for me. And in an ideal world, I'd like, you know, conversational Spanish would probably be really useful to me. And I guess the way I think about social media is that I want to, you know enough to be able to participate in the conversation as I want to.
Was there?
I have two specific questions about adding public speaking to your quiver. The first one is, how do you pitch yourself as a public speaker? And the second is, how do you price yourself?
In my case, the prices are all over, just all over the map. And you know, I've had a couple of really lucrative gigs, and I've had a lot of so-so gigs, and I've had a lot of things that hardly paid for what I did but built platform or were audiences that I wanted to reach, or I was selling books. And, you know, so there's a lot of ways to make money on these things that maybe you don't think of. So, you know, if you're, you know, in my case, I had a book that was doing reasonably well, and I don't know if you guys read this, but you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, Dick Cavett had written this really funny piece for the New York Times about, you know, being sent out to a big book talk and being really hyped up for it and arriving and finding out that not only did the publisher not send any promotional materials to the bookstore, they didn't send any of his books. And you know, this is a, you know, celebrity writer. And you know, the book, I mean, I left news and moved into books thinking, thank God I'm getting out of this screwed up news business that's falling apart, only to find out that the book business is every bit as screwed up as the news business. What I would do is I would buy my own book, even though it's a violation of contract, and I'd have 40 or, you know, 50 of my own books in the trunk of my car. And so I would take speaking gigs that didn't pay all that well, knowing that I'd be able to sell some books. And so the speaking gig might have only paid me, you know, $300 or $400. But if I sell 10 books out of it, then I more than doubled that. So there's creative ways of doing that. The other thing is to pitch yourself is, and this is something I meant to mention earlier on, if you're going to expand and you're going to have a quiver, and I'm terrible at this, but it's really important, is to document yourself doing these things. Get photos, get video, get a record of you doing all of these other things, and most importantly, get video or a tape of you speaking when you're doing one of those gigs, to show that you're compelling. And maybe you only put up a 4 or 5 minute clip. Maybe you just put up the climax of a little story, but put it up on your website. And so then you've got something for somebody to look at and say, hey, wow, they're actually a pretty good speaker. And that brought me a lot. I never really put stuff up on my website, but I had a couple of things that were televised. And through that, while I was doing my book, I did one of... I don't know if they're still doing it, but they did a Books at Google thing where they would bring in an author. In my case, they brought me into Google in Cambridge. And they would have you do an hour-long talk, and they'd buy like 100 of your books for Google at a discount from the publisher. So I didn't get paid for that. The publisher got, you know, some really good book sales out of it. But I can tell you that when Google put that up online and it was all over the place, I got all kinds of calls to come and speak, and those were paying gigs. So, you know, you kind of have to be strategic about it. And I've never had a book agent, and none of the ones I've talked to have been all that interested in me. And then when I talked to my literary agent about it, her attitude was, why do you want a speaking agent? You're doing better than you're going to do with a speaking agent just doing it on your own. I don't think that's the case for everybody.
Actually, I just wanted to make a bit of an announcement. This whole subject about multimedia and photography and writing, we're going to discuss at greater length at a network lunch on Friday. So it's number one on the list. Come and have lunch with us. We'll discuss it at greater length. Thanks.
Mine isn't really a question. What I was going to say was you can make alliances at things like SEJ. Krista Schuyler recently sold 20 books to locals in my town because I did an interview with her. So I sold a piece to the radio station, and she sold books, and everybody wins. So,
I'll follow that up just pointing out. So back to the book thing and publishers. And I have to say my last publisher actually, you know, basically compared to every author I've talked to, treated me really, really well. But by my measure of all the things they should have done, I thought they were doing really poorly. And so almost all of the really good successes I had, national TV, radio, were things I arranged on my own. And you can apply that not just to books but to other projects that you want to do. I mean, you've got a great network of other media people. So, you know, I got a review in the New York Times book review, and I don't know why I got it, but I do know that I called a friend of mine and said, hey, my book is out. I know I haven't talked to you in 3.5 years, but can I send you a copy? And he sent me a note when he got the book, and he says, I'm walking it over to the book review right now. And every time when I was touring my book, every town I went to on another assignment, I called as soon as I knew I was going there and said, hey, can I speak to somebody at the local public radio station? Can I do something on your TV station? You know, I'm going to be here. I'll add, you know, half a day onto the time I'm in town, or a full day if you want me to come into your bookstore and talk. And none of those things were arranged by the publisher. They were all just by me networking with friends or other media people that I knew, or just cold calling TV stations.
Yeah, and for that matter, I wouldn't even be doing radio if it wasn't for the freelance thing last year. So, because I met everybody here, and that's why I'm doing it.
One more quick question from anybody?
Hi. With so many things in your quiver, how many hours a week do you work?
In my case, and I think this is the case for everybody. I may be just an extreme example right now, but you know, whatever, a year and a half ago, I was twiddling my thumbs going, my God, this is a really expensive town and I'm hardly getting any work and this book isn't going to pay for me to live here. Maybe we need to move. And now I have, you know, like a full-time job on top of a full-time job. So it's just really extreme feast or famine. The other thing is, I'm probably really fortunate, but I have trouble saying no just because everything's really exciting for me right now. I just have a lot of things coming my way that I really like, and I don't have much of a social life right now. On the other hand, I don't really miss it. You know, all the reporting I'm doing right now is really fun. I really like teaching, and it probably wasn't necessarily the greatest timing to have, you know, a deadline coming up on a book that I really felt was full-time and then take a big full-time job. But on the other hand, the nature of doing the long-term projects is that you have very intensive parts of time that are very social, where you're out reporting and calling people and traveling and doing all this cool stuff, and then you're living in a cave and you go and you see yourself in a mirror and there's like eggs from 3 days ago on your hoodie and you realize that you haven't shaved in God knows how long, and I kind of got tired of that aspect of it. So now I have something where I'm fully engaged all the time. I got to get out and teach. I've got to go break myself away from this project, and I'm working with really smart people that I really enjoy working with. So that's actually kind of an X factor thing there, where I actually think that both types of work that I'm doing right now, as far as teaching and then journalism, are better for my involvement in the other one.
And I'll just add to that in that I would say I've alluded to this before. I'm in a little bit of a transitional phase because when I was in New York, I referred to myself as the cash flow queen. In that the money had to, you know, the money really had to arrive for everything to happen. So it was a lot of how, I mean, I really had to focus on that profit portion of that three-legged stool. When we moved, I suddenly had some flexibility. And so, I mean, you know, where I was crazy, you know, so where I was crazy busy and really focused on that, what I have been trying to do is I'm pruning the quiver actually a bit. So you know, there's certain I haven't you know, it's not like I've cut certain things out, but I've dialed certain things back to make room
for the new things that I want to do. And so I think that's another thing to keep in mind, is that sometimes, you know, something that works really well for you, if there are changes, you know, or you want to grow in a new way, sometimes you have to make some adjustments, and maybe maybe there's something that you completely cut back entirely, or you dial back and you find strategies to make the space. I've been in the process of making the space, and now I'm trying to fill it with the other things that are going to be the passion career building things that I'm now in a position to do. But I think that's part of it. The quiver isn't static. The quiver continues to grow and change and evolve.
Thank you very, very much, Sarah Michael. Thank you.